Thank you, Klaus. I want to thank Joe, Mike, Paul, and Carlo, the organizers, for inviting me and everybody else and all the work they did in order to organize this workshop. I always have too many transparencies, so that shouldn't be a cause of concern to you. We'll edit on the fly. What I did is I put together a talk which I hoped would serve as an introduction for those of you who haven't heard me talk before to this emerging field of nanomechanical systems and point out some interesting things to think about. Some of the stuff that, you know, for those of you who have heard me talk about this before and perhaps even recently, I try to put in some of the newest stuff that's going on in our group at Caltech. So here's an overview of things that I brought to talk to you about. First of all, a very quick overview of nanomechanical systems for people who haven't heard me talk about this before. And then here are the topics that I brought. Why it's interesting to go to high-frequency mechanical systems, thinking about trying to make large-scale integration of nanomechanical devices. And one of the interesting applications that's emerging, which is mass sensing and mass spectrometry. I will also talk about some of the physics of these nanomechanical devices in solution. All this stuff up here is in vacuum. And in fact, the ultimate limits part of the talk will be vacuum-based applications. But there's some interesting stuff that I'm pursuing and, in fact, actually starting a company. I'm taking a leave of absence from Caltech for a year to do this, basically developing biosensors in solution. And in the last part of the talk, I'll talk about quantum limits that we're trying to approach. I'm still going to be, by the way, I said I'm going to take a leave of absence. I'm still going to run my research group anyway to actually pursue some of these things. So the background for the talk is basically that through microfabrication technology and different etching processes, it's been possible to make three-dimensional microstructures. And with those three-dimensional microstructures, this degree of freedom of the mechanical dimension becomes this domain becomes open to us, and we can think about new functionality. And sort of where I started when I went to Caltech about 8 years ago was this field existed, microelectromechanical systems, and I thought it would be interesting to actually combine techniques that we have for actually getting into the nanoscale to push towards ultimately this, you know, futuristic vision of nanomachines. And the way we're doing that primarily now, at least in the last 8 years, has been using all the techniques from mesoscopic systems, and the primary lithographic technique is electron beam lithography, to actually carve things down to get into this scale. The point is, just like those MEMS devices that I showed you that have integrated transducers, arbitrary geometry, that actually do something because they incorporate all these things, we're trying to make functional nanoscale devices that actually have some sort of mechanical element to their operation. Here's devices that we've made over the past 8 years or so, starting from the first very crude devices made by Andrew Cleland when he was a postdoc in my group. He's now a professor here at Santa Barbara, all the way up to sort of current devices made out of gallium arsenide. We've actually been doing things in nanotubes and nanowires, and that's what I think the future is, but still using electron beam lithography. It gives us a lot of power to actually define things with control that we don't yet have in the growth of nanotubes and nanowires, as you'll see. So surface, how we actually make these things is through surface nanomachining. We combine epitaxial semiconductor heterostructures, electron beam lithography, and these various etching techniques that I talked about from sort of the MEMS world. The simplest incarnation of the process to make these devices is we have these heterostructures that are grown with monolayer precision. And in the simplest form, we might have two layers on top of a substrate. One layer is a sacrificial layer with a specific chemical composition that will be important when we get to the end of the process. Step two, we define a mask by now a combination of electron beam and optical lithography. We use these various fancy etching techniques, which allow us to cut through all the layers, you know, anisotropically like a cookie cutter. And at the end of the day, we have one chemically selective etch that allows us to freely suspend the devices. This is surface nanomachining, sort of from the front side only, but we can actually do things from the back and the front. So we can do fairly general things, you know, from all directions at this point. The point basically is by combining electron beam lithography with epitaxy, we actually have control over all three directions in space and can make these three-dimensional nanostructures. And the materials that we've been focusing on are gallium arsenide, silicon, and silicon carbide. One of the principal motivations just is illustrated in this slide here. This shows a mechanical resonator, a doubly clamped beam, which is the boundary condition that's pictured in this row here. And what I'm showing you is a chart showing resonant frequency as a function of materials in the different colors and dimensions, spanning from the size of MEMS, 100 microns long, 3 microns wide, 1,000 angstroms thick, all the way down to sort of the state-of-the-art electron beam lithography. And what you can see is the fundamental frequency scales up into the microwave range. So that's really quite interesting, because you can now rethink what an electrical device is. An electrical device can have motion, and that motion can be on the same sort of time scale that we now shuttle charges in electronic devices. So you can actually think about doing signal processing in the mechanical domain way up here at microwave frequencies. So, you know, part of this whole scheme that we've been pushing on is actually defining multi-port devices, multi-terminal devices, where the functionality is derived mechanically in the mechanical domain. You can do signal processing, measurement, or computation. In fact, Babbage's first computers were, of course, mechanical devices. For now, we're getting signals from the electrical domain. I have racks of equipment that I probe these samples with. We're getting them from the electrical domain into the mechanical domain, so we need input transducers. And it turns out that there's a host of physical processes that we can use to convert from the optical or the electrical domain into the mechanical domain, and at the end of the day, back out, you know, to read things out. For the purposes of this meeting, one of the interesting things, of course, to point out is that we can think about temperatures in the millikelvin range on dilution refrigerators, where in fact we could actually freeze out thermal fluctuations in these devices. And now the modes of these devices and the quanta of these devices become very interesting. So we'll talk about that. That will be the ultimate limits that I get to at the end of the talk. Any questions so far? Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about how far we've gotten. I've told you now that we can make mechanical devices using state-of-the-art electron beam lithography that should have resonant frequencies up at 12 gigahertz. How far have we gotten? Well, we have only gotten part way up. In fact, here's the state-of-the-art right now. I think this is still a record. I mean, records are broken all the time, but this is the current record in this field. Currently from my group, we're trading off with other groups, of course, from time to time, a 633 megahertz silicon carbide resonator. This basically is just a plot showing different materials, resonant frequencies as a function of these normalized dimensions of a doubly clamped beam. Here's what the device looks like, and I put this up here both for experimentalists but also for theorists to show that as you actually try to do the experiments, things get pretty complicated. It turns out to actually extract the moving signals from these beams, the motion will be angstrom scale or smaller. And so it becomes very, very difficult as you go up in frequency and as you scale down in size. The motion gets proportionately smaller as you scale down in size. And so we've actually developed in this thing to read out these 630 megahertz resonance, these kind of UHF bridges to read things out. So one of the challenges of this field is not so much actually fabricating the nanoscale devices, but it's all sort of the connections from the real world down to interrogate them. And that's really the bottleneck. One of the things that play a role in the latter part of the talk when I talk about ultimate limits. One of the things that we've been pursuing is not only trying to optimize the transducers that allow us to read motion, but to figure out if we could use the nonlinear properties of the device themselves to, in effect, give us gain right at the front end in the mechanical domain of the device. And one way you can do that is by making a mechanical parametric amplifier, and that's what this simple structure is, which is two wide beams that suspend a third thin beam, and then we have electrodes on the top. And the way this thing actually works is you put a magnetic field on this thing. So if this thing moves, it generates an EMF that you can detect in this electrode. And the first thing we do is we've arranged things where we can actually drive these outer beams to move in and out through a Lorentz force that's induced by a time-varying current that's in this magnetic field. That actually modulates the strain in this beam. Okay, so that's the parametric modulation. So you can think of that as a pump force. We drive that at 40 megahertz. And then you can apply a signal force very weakly and actually get parametric gain. Okay, and so what you end up doing at the end of the day is you read the response of your signal force at 20 megahertz, but you actually have in the mechanical domain this parametric gain. And what's quite surprising is this works really well. You can actually get a peak gain of 1,000 or 60 dB in the power domain using this sort of mechanical parametric effect. Here's an example of looking in the phasor plane. I mean, part of the reason, I'll just say right now, one of the things that I was going to say in the end, part of the thing that we're interested in is actually making mechanical devices that ultimately work up at the quantum limit, and actually applying in the mechanical domain a lot of analogies that can be made to optical or nonlinear optics, quantum optics. And so one of them is, of course, could you think about making squeezed mechanical states? And so the first step is to actually make some sort of a parametric or nonlinear amplifier. So here's an example in the phasor play of a coherent signal that's applied at 20 megahertz. Okay, and this little red ball here is the noise at the tip of that phasor associated from the thermal fluctuations. As we increase the pump and we increase the gain of the system, you can see actually that this red ball is not increasing in size. And what that's a sign of is that, in fact, the fundamental thermodynamic fluctuations, the thermomechanical noise of this, is actually not governing the output that we're seeing. It's not governing the size of this red ball, because, in fact, we're second stage limited in this device. We're not limited by the mechanical fluctuations. But as we increase the parametric gain, you can see that ultimately, ultimately, if you blow this thing up, you can see along one direction in the phase plane, we actually have phase-sensitive gain. And so now, in fact, we're exceeding the fluctuations of the system and actually mechanically amplifying the thermal noise. So this is an important step for us at low temperature to be able to see the thermal noise in the beam, because the next step is to actually be able to cool things down and see the quantum limit. One of the interesting things about mechanical devices is not so much the individual elements, which is of course where you start, and it's pretty much what's occupied us for the last 8 years, but actually gaining these things, coupling them in linear or nonlinear ways and gaining new functionality. And it turns out, actually, if you even look in the field of MEMS, very little has been done in coupling large arrays of mechanical devices, you know, through direct fabrication. And so we set out to do this in my group. This is done by A.L. Books, who's finishing a postdoc in my group before he goes to the Technion. These are some devices he made, which are doubly clamped gold beams that are suspended above a hole in a membrane. Okay, and in fact, the beams can be separately charged because every other beam is connected to either this electrode or that electrode. Okay, so what can we do with these things? Well, we can have a mechanical system where we can tune the electrostatic coupling, the nearest neighbor interactions, if you will, electrostatically between these beams. One of the interesting techniques that he developed was the ability to characterize each and every one of the mechanical elements in the system right in the electron microscope. We can actually get subangstrom displacement sensitivity by tapping into our electron microscope. And through this technique, at room temperature, he can characterize the mechanical resonance of an individual beam and then scan through the whole array of beams and actually look at the dispersion, you know, I mean, the variation in frequencies that are basically fabrication induced. And what you can see is that this is basically, you know, shows the fidelity of our nanofabrication. It's a few parts per thousand, each of these different beams. When we apply the electrostatic the alternating electrostatic voltage to these beams, then we begin to form bands, you know, collective modes in this mechanical system, sort of one-dimensional phonons is a simple way of thinking about it, although it turns out that the physics, the dominant physics, becomes very different as we start to turn up the gain, as you'll see, turn up the drive, as you see. So here's the first three modes for this array of something like 70 mechanical devices that are electrostatically coupled. The way we read these things out is we send, we built a fiber optic interferometer, and we actually look at the diffraction pattern from this array. And we can actually see the spread in the diffraction pattern that tells us something interesting about the mechanical devices. The way we've set things up, we can not only apply a DC voltage to actually fix what the coupling is between the beams, but we can also apply an AC voltage to parametrically drive the system. And when you do that, you actually see this very interesting nonlinear response. I mean, this whole thing that we're actually grappling with studying and trying to understand the interactions. But basically, this is a color code showing the response. And you can see there's a whole series of very strong parametric resonances in this system. What this is the frequency response of the system. Down here is what you would see the response of the system at zero voltage, this would just show the spread, the fabrication-induced spread in resonant frequencies. But as we turn up the coupling voltage, this band of parametric resonances emerge. Technologically, that's just what you get from the 1D phonon theory. Okay. Technologically, this is interesting because you can actually think about applying time-varying signals to this device, and you know, with just a couple of components, you can actually make a real-time Fourier spectrum analyzer, because each Fourier component is actually diffracted at a different, each Fourier component of this time-varying waveform is diffracted at a different angle. So that's part of the interest that some of the technological funding agencies have in the kind of work that we're doing. One of the other interesting things about nanomechanical systems that we're pursuing is they're very good mass sensors. And here's an example. You can ask the simple question, if I have a doubly clamped beam, if gas is adsorbing and desorbing, how much stuff do I need on here in order to shift the resonant frequency downward by a half width? And you do a simple back of the envelope calculation, you find out that it's very, very small. It basically scales like the active mass of the beam, the mass normalized to the mode shape, divided by the Q. And the Q of these mechanical systems can be quite high. In the regime that we're at now, it turns out that this normalized to the mass of a hydrogen atom, so in other words, for biologists, in Daltons, this is something like 180,000 Daltons. But we think that we can actually get down to the regime where we can actually do single molecule sensing with individual Dalton sensitivity, and that's for two reasons. One is we're going to higher frequencies, as I'll show you, but also clearly you can resolve the shift of the centroid of this resonance line by something that's much smaller than the line width, maybe a part and third of the, part and tenth of the third of the line width. So this heralds in my group, this work, a new sort of thrust that we've gone off into, which is trying to do work at UHV on these nanomechanical systems, realizing that the properties of the surface, I mean, the properties of the device are going to be completely susceptible to what's on the surface, even down at the few molecule scale. So we've taken the approach that we had to bite the bullet and actually build UHV systems to put these devices in so that we can actually control their surface properties. And even the first experiments that we did are beginning to be interesting. This is work done by postdoc Camilla Kinchy in my group. And what he did is from the top, he fired down pulses of gold atoms from a thermal source down to this nanomechanical device that's read out in a phase lock loop. This is a 33 megahertz device. This shows the pulses of gold that's applied to the surface. These are 40 attograms, or 4 times 10 to the minus 17 grams of gold applied to the surface. And you can see with good signal to noise, we can actually see these pulses applied. In fact, this has quite small resolution of about 2 times 10 to the minus 18 grams, which no other mass sensor so far has given. That's a 33 megahertz resonator. As we go up in frequency, the response to added mass is even steeper. This 72 megahertz beam gives us a frequency shift of 1 hertz for only about 300 gold atoms added. So as we go up in frequency, we're trying to make projections of, could we actually use this for mass spectrometry? I'm happy to privately to explain how we talk about this equation that we got to, which describes the mass sensitivity of these mechanical devices. Turns out you can have this very simple form that just depends on the parameters of the resonator itself, its mass and Q, and the dynamic range of the readout system that you have. But the bottom line is that this simple formula explains quite well, within a factor of two or so, the mass sensitivity that we have in our current device. And so we can think about, in next generation, moving forward towards actually trying to weigh individual atoms with these kinds of systems. Let me just skip through this to the punchline at the end. We're at 600 megahertz now. We have only applied 30 megahertz to mass sensing. But at 800 megahertz, we think that we can actually weigh individual atoms like biomolecules and have single Dalton resolution. So this basically would be many order of magnitude improvement for mass spectrometry. And that mass spectrometry is one of the important tools going into this era of proteomics that will be used actually to solve these things. So this is actually one of the detection techniques that we're pushing forward on. you know, as a commercial possibility. I wanted to say something about detecting, before I get to quantum limited stuff, detecting mechanical forces in solution. In the genomics project, one of the things that's very interesting, or not very interesting, but absolutely crucial in actually unraveling things, is when you have a whole bunch of oligomers in solution, when you actually try to figure out what they are, you need this technique, which is these microarrays. These are made by crude optical lithography. This shows a process above here, where you build up sequentially the matching sequence of nucleotides on a chip, and then preferentially the thing that you're looking for will bind to any given one of these spots, and only one or a few. And when it binds, since the thing that that you've introduced in solution is fluorescently labeled, you can read this out. So we asked the question, is it possible to think of using nanoscale techniques to actually make such a system that doesn't require something like 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 6 atoms for detection, but you could actually maybe detect a single atom? And of course, since I'm interested in mechanical systems, I'm going to approach this mechanically. And in fact, an interesting motivational question is, there are certain biomolecules in the cell that maybe only have 2 or 3 copies. And if you would actually like to do an assay of a single cell to understand its life history or the evolution or how, for example, DNA is transcribed, you'd need to have single molecule sensitivity. But this basically shows the volume scale, the copy scale, and the time scale that you would like to have this sort of technique to work. So we're proposing using these force assays for single molecule detection. This is actually already known from chemical force microscopy. The difference is we're trying to make arrays and scale these down into the nanometer scale. The bottom line is chemical bonds are broken with forces that are on the scale of 10 nanonewtons, but hydrogen bonds are broken with forces that are on the scale of piconewtons. So you'd like your single molecule detector to be sensitive on the sort of piconewton scale. Keep that in mind. Okay. These are various techniques, chemical force microscopy, optical tweezers, which you probably know about, that allow people to grab onto single molecules now. But what we're interested in is actually doing this kind of chip-based approach. And so the idea is, through single molecule interactions, actually trying to modify the mechanical properties of a device in solution. Is it feasible to actually think about being able to do this, and then furthermore scaling this with electronic readout into large arrays? So our approach is to make these cantilevers. I'm going to show you a hierarchy. We're actually making these things now. In fact, here's a picture of one of these things, and this is what we're scaling into, which is sort of 300 angstroms long, 1,000 angstroms wide, 300 angstroms thick, 1,000 angstroms wide, and 3 microns long. And it will turn out, as I'll show you in a moment, that the properties of this device will be sufficient to allow you to do single molecule sensing with this sort of microsecond timescale resolution. This is just, I'm going to be around this week and next week, although I won't be here tomorrow. This is just to show you that all of the same form for mechanical response holds true, but in fact the primary thing about these nanomechanical devices in solution is that they're heavily damped and they're driven by Brownian fluctuations. Originally, when I first started thinking about these devices, I assumed that the properties of the mechanical device in solution, the Q was going to go, say, from 100,000 down to 0.01, and that was going to be such a sufficient drop in performance that you wouldn't be able to detect very sensitively any forces at sort of the molecular scale at all. But the point to be made is that nano cantilevers in vacuum can have force sensitivity that's on the scale of attonewtons, 10 to the minus 18 newtons. We've demonstrated that, and some other groups have. So even if you take a factor of 1,000 hit in their sensitivity, you still have the ability to sense, as I'll show you. Let me just go through this now. Sorry about the too many slides here. But here's a plot of the predicted frequency response. This is where we're trying to go in the next year or so, for this small nano cantilever that's fluid loaded. And what you see is the force noise spectral density in newtons per root hertz as a function of the frequency of this device. This is heavily damped. Its Q is something like 0.01 0.1 or 0.01, so you can't really think of it as a resonant system. Here's the thermodynamic limit for the force sensitivity that you could have for this device, determined by Brownian fluctuations in solution. And what you can see is it's a few times 10 to the minus 15, a few femtonewtons per root hertz. So even if you integrate, say, up to a megahertz or larger, you still end up having a force sensitivity, integrated force sensitivity, that's at this scale of breaking individual hydrogen bonds. So that's why we're pursuing and we're going forward with this kind of technique. The way that you actually use these things in solution then is, for example, you can detect the presence, you know, the linkage. And in fact, this kind of detector can be present to something that competes with this interaction and actually causes an unbinding. Or you can make, you can biofunctionalize these, the stationary part and the moving part, with different molecules that preferentially bind to something in solution. So that's how these things will be used. Okay. And these things will be part of microfluidic systems. Let me get now to the last part of the talk so that I don't run out of time and I leave enough time for questions. Again, this is supposed to just be tantalizing and to form the basis for discussions that go on through the next couple of weeks while I'm here. What are the ultimate limits of nanomechanical devices? Well, I already said that using electron beam lithography, we could get out here, and out here is far enough up in frequency where if you put these things on a dilution refrigerator, you can actually freeze out thermal fluctuations and you'd be governed by sort of zero-point noise and in a sort of a quantum limit for mechanical systems. This has already been demonstrated nicely by one of the organizers, Paul McCune, Hong Kong Park, when he was in Paul's group, that the ultimate limit sort of for mechanical systems really is going to be sort of molecular vibrations. And this example, which you probably all know about, but I wanted to point out in this context as representing some sort of view of what the ultimate limit is for nanomechanical devices, basically is sort of terahertz frequency vibrations of these buckyballs and van der Waals potential. So ultimately, I think all the stuff that we're carving using electron beam lithography, even growing using nanowires, is going to be supplanted in the next decade when we know actually how to fabricate sort of from the bottom up individual molecules that will do give us the mechanical performance and device that we want. But one of the towering challenges in doing that is not only making the devices we want, but learning how to couple to them. So sort of with that vista, it's interesting to ask, well, how will quantum effects in mechanical devices, you know, what's the sequence in which they'll be realized? And I think, you know, this is sort of my view, which is just one person's view. But probably it will go something like this, three milestones. The first milestone is just around the corner for us, and that is actually having mechanical systems where the number of quanta, number of thermally, you know, occupied quanta or thermally accessible quanta is much greater than one, let's say 20, 50 or something like that, but not, you know, infinite. So we could actually see the discreteness in the mechanical states of the system. And then going on from that is actually getting, you know, into the sort of pure quantum limit. This is where quantum optics actually lives now. And, you know, we're only getting up close to this. So let me talk about this first one, observing quantum jumps. This is actually motivated by this first experiment published in 95, but made out of, based on devices that Andrew first started making in my group in 93, which if cooled to 100 millidegrees should only have something, they're 100 megahertz, about, well, they're 70 megahertz devices. And if cooled to 100 millidegrees, they'll have something like 20 thermally occupied quanta in the fundamental mode at 100 millidegrees. So you could ask the question, could I configure my measurement in such a way that I could actually see quantum jumps as this thing exchanges with the outside world individual quanta? And there's a couple of requirements for doing that, which are not easy, but I think we can get to. The point, of course, being that the mean squared displacement in these systems can be quantized if we arrange things to be in a number state. So that's the first requirement. We have to make sure that the system is in a number state. And that would require two things, or that could be realized in two ways. The first way is that the Q of the mechanical system is large, so the dissipation is small over the time scale of the measurement. You know, that's the first requirement. The second requirement is that whatever transducer, whatever readout scheme that we couple to this thing, better not couple to linear degrees of freedom, but we want to couple to, say, position squared or momentum. And it's possible to do that. In fact, There's a whole lore from gravitational wave detection of people worrying about how to make couplings, nonlinear couplings, or sorry, higher level couplings, not linear couplings, to mechanical systems. And we think that we can build those things in. In fact, that parametric device that I showed you is one way that we've already demonstrated that we can do square law coupling to mechanical devices in the mechanical domain. The second thing is, though, that once we force the system to be in a number state, so it should be undergoing these number state transitions, you still have to have a displacement detection that's sensitive to actually see the discreteness in mean squared amplitude upon addition or subtraction of an individual quanta. This is too much detail for this short talk, but I will, if anybody's interested in how I did this, I'm happy. It's just seat-of-the-pants experimentalist use of simple harmonic oscillator theory to derive this. The bottom line, though, is it gives us, you know, if you just think about things carefully, you can actually base how sensitive your minimum displacement sensitivity should be. Here's the sensitivity of the displacement required, the displacement spectral density, normalized to the sort of the fundamental jump, if you will. And as the number of quanta go up, there's this factor that you have to be better and better than what you would have to do if you're at the quantum limit in sensitivity. And so let's look at this sort of target resonator that we have here. I mean, this is basically technology that we had something like 6 years ago. What that requires in order to see quantum jumps is a displacement sensitivity that's about 10 to the minus 5 angstroms per root hertz. Okay, that sounds incredibly small, but we're only about a factor of 10 away from that. We're still working towards that. So I think we should be able to have the displacement sensitivity to see these individual jumps. There's an interesting point before I get on to milestone 2 and milestone 3. There's an interesting point to be made here is that I'm talking about looking at mean squared amplitude to look at quantum jumps in mechanical systems. But in fact, this other work that we've been doing, which you may know about, which led to observing the thermal conductance quantum, should allow us to do the same thing bolometrically. And the point to be made here, or the connection, is that mechanical vibrations in the frequency range that we're talking about, 500 megahertz to 5 gigahertz, are basically realized by thermal phonons in the range of 10 millidegrees to 100 millidegrees. That's where the dominant phonon wavelength is. And so we can actually think about these fundamental mechanical vibrations as actually being the phonons of these isolated systems. And this is just a summary chart, you know, from a complete other talk that I've given, which I probably most of you have seen, which actually is our sort of our holy grail of where we want to go using these suspended devices, the same sort of devices that we made to observe the thermal conductance quantum. Well, there's some small variations. They're all semiconductor in these devices. But the bottom line is the heat capacity at low temperatures of these is so small, and our local thermometry for these suspended reservoirs is sufficiently high in resolution that we should be able to see individual quanta being exchanged in this system. And so in some sense, that's a direct analog to the kinds of measurements I was talking about for looking mechanical jumps. Okay, let me end very quickly with what the other two milestones are and why, you know, what the barriers are to actually realizing them. Obviously, we'd like to be in the limit where we make the frequency so high and the temperature so low that we only have, that essentially we freeze out all thermal occupation in these modes. And clearly that requires higher frequency vibrators, better transducers, and this important question of thermalizing them. Better displacement transducers is a difficult problem. I mean, this is the point that I was trying to make at the beginning, that there's a whole bunch of techniques from microscale mechanical systems that just basically crap out when you get down to the nanoscale. And so it really requires quite a lot of work, experimental work, to actually make sensitive displacement transducers at the quantum limit. And then, of course, there's an important question that when we make the devices really small, this thermal conductance quantum problem, they're going to be electrically isolated, so thermalizing them is going to pose a difficulty as well. So this is not particularly an easy domain to go off into, but nonetheless, I think it's really quite interesting. However, let's assume we're there. We actually have quantum limited performance in mechanical devices. Then it's quite possible to use the nonlinearities in mechanical systems to actually play these games of quantum optics. And in fact, already 10 years ago, Dan Ruger, in collaboration with Gruter, actually showed in the thermal limit that he could use nonlinearities in mechanical systems to achieve sort of squeezing of the thermomechanical noise, not the quantum noise. So we'd like to actually push forward with these kind of devices at low temperatures to actually realize squeezing in the quantum limit at some point in the future. The final transparency that I have, well, I have two other things that I want to mention to you. This is the final sort of conceptual transparency. We're doing this work using mechanical systems, which I haven't talked about at all, to do magnetic resonance imaging. And the point here is to actually try to ultimately have magnetic resonance imaging with single spin. The theory for this force-detected magnetic resonance assumes the mechanical system is just a classical spring. And what's clear is that once we get to the limit of being able to detect and couple directly at the Larmor frequency to the spin system, it turns out that the mechanical system that's up to the task is one, in fact, that's at or near the quantum limit. And so the correct formulation of the problem that's required is, in fact, one in which we think about entangled states between mechanical and spin systems. This has been proposed as an alternate readout for a quantum computer. My next to last transparency is just to thank all the talented people that I've been involved with. And this is as some of you know, this is a typical device that we make, which is collapsed. The final transparency I wanted to put up is that I've organized and have obtained sufficient funding from DARPA to put together this conference discussing all these, bringing from, for example, molecular motors, nanotubes from the bottom up, and then top down kind of stuff like I was talking about. A new international conference to actually try to bring together all these different fields. We have a website, molecular-mechanics.org. There's not much on there now, but in the next couple of weeks it will be expanded. And I hope if this kind of stuff is interesting to you that you'll come and help play a role in building this field. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So we had not too many discussions in between, so now we have 10 minutes left.
You mentioned that you needed the number state, I mean, as initial state for your resonator to do CV's transitions, right? Now, what freedom do you have to choose your initial states? For example, something like a coherent state, is that something you would naturally be able to generate? Or?
Well, in the limit where the Q is high, I mean, which is the limit that I was talking about here, in the absence of any transducers, then presumably you'd just be in a thermal state because it's only the reservoirs that it interacts with the outside world. So it wouldn't have any reason to be in any other state. But if you can actually make these sort of square law transducers, then you can actually drive them in. I mean, the assumption, the discussion, but there's really, this is all done so far in the absence of any detailed theory, and that's actually, some people I know are interested in beginning to work on these kinds of things, is that the coupling to the transducer would actually force you into these kind of number states, which is dictated by the precise nature of the coupling that you engineer. So I would only say ignorant things if I try to say anything beyond that. So this is something we definitely need help to figure out how to do this.
I have some question to the mass-sensitive measurements.
Yes.
Are they selective, or can you do the selective?
Yeah, well, so there's two regimes that we're in. The first limit is that right now we can detect detect a click every time a 100 kilodalton molecule comes in. Those just our first experiments gave that. But what you would like to do ultimately is to weigh individual molecules. By weigh, I mean a click comes in, and not only do you know the molecule came, but you know to single Dalton resolution exactly what its mass was, or maybe even better.
Is the position not important?
Yes. No, so you're thinking about time of flight. Time of flight is usually used to do mass selection. And the way mass spectrometry, for the most part, I mean, one of the main schemes by which it's done commercially now is you have a bunch of stuff, all sorts of different molecules in there. It gets ionized, and then it flows through and accelerated through some short acceleration chamber, and then it's all the different species are emerging with different velocities. And you just wait long enough, and they separate in space, and then your detector just registers clicks. So you know at mass, you know, whatever, you got a click.
No, my question was, if you add additional mass in the center of your vibrating or at the end.
Oh,
the,
no, that's an important point. And so, you know, the commercial realization will require actually focusing lenses to make sure, you know, that that doesn't give you spread. But that's right. The mass sensitivity is different depending on the position of the beam.
Mentioned this diffraction, I think optical diffraction,
right,
from the set of parallel lines, and the broadening you said was due to fluctuations.
No, we're not at the limit where we can actually see the thermodynamic fluctuations of these things. The broadening of the diffraction line just relates to the fabrication-induced spread in our current system. Yeah.
Otherwise, you would have the bipolar factor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the original hope, was that this might be a different way at getting at the quantum limit, that we could actually use the Debye-Waller factor. But it just turns out, when you go through all the numbers, I mean, basically it relates to the mass of the system, of these nanomechanical systems, compared to the mass of an atom, that, you know, by basically that ratio, things are suppressed that you see in atomic physics.
If you think about it, the diffraction from a disordered ray.
Yeah, exactly. But in terms of, you know, the interest for actually arriving at some sort of technological functionality, it's just making sure that that spread is narrow enough so that you can actually create some sort of a Fourier analysis in space through the different angles that the different Fourier components come out on. This is similar to what's done already in electro-optic elements for optics, but the interesting thing here is it's extremely low power and the part count is basically two, you know, a nanomechanical device and a diode array.
Down.
Yeah.
What temperatures are now accessible?
Okay, well, the best example would be these experiments that we've been doing looking at thermal conductance quantization, because that's where we really tried to push the temperature down. And also, those represent systems that are the most isolated of the suspended nanostructures that we can make. I mean, as soon as you start putting electrical transducers and stuff, then you can have other thermal pathways that you can actually cool the device down. So let's pick those, where we've intentionally used superconductors to electrically isolate, so the only thermalization path is through the phonon channel. And in those devices, temperature seems to hang up something like about 70 millidegrees. This is, you know, all relates though, you know, in steady state, it just relates to external heat load. It could be noise, you know, we don't know what, but this is in a carefully shielded environment, but these are some of the lowest heat capacity samples that are the most isolated that have been made and then directly measured. So we don't understand the reason why the temperature hangs up, because our engineering and predictions are that it should hang up at much lower temperature, at many orders of magnitude lower. So this is a current area of work. I think it might be of interest to some of the community here that one of the things that we haven't done is look at the long-term decay or the long-term dynamics of the system. And it may be possible that basically some of these isolated degrees of freedom are not cooling. So one of the set of experiments that I'd like to do is to actually look and see if there's long-time tails in the cooling associated with, you know, two-level systems, presence of two-level systems or something like that. We haven't done that yet.
When you have one of those molecules coming in and then being stuck, vibrating beam, that molecule, of course, brings along with itself a lot of kinetic energy.
Right.
What happens to that kinetic energy? Which part of it goes into this, the mode that you're sensing, which part goes where, what else?
Right, that's a good question. So, I mean, that's going to depend on the details of the mechanical system itself and how that that impulse is actually, you know, ultimately thermalized. For the experiments that we did, basically the mechanical resonator and the beam was separately moderated and thermalized, you know, so that And at the same time, we were able to monitor the deposition of heat in the system so that we knew it was just mass and not either it bringing extra energy because it was hot or actually impact noise. But, you know, the bottom line is I don't know. It depends on the exact system. And these are absolutely the first experiments that we've done. And one of the interesting things that we thought about doing was
a significant part of that energy goes into the vibrating mode.
Exactly.
Correspond to many phonons in that mode.
Exactly. And so one of the things that we hope that we might be able to do is use the mechanical degrees of freedom effectively to actually look at these single molecule absorption and thermalization processes and the dynamics of that. We wouldn't be able to look in the temporal domain, at least in the short term, because, you know, we're talking about, you know, higher frequencies for the surface vibrational modes than the mechanical devices themselves. But we should be able to actually see on the thermalization time scale, the thermalization from, you know, some hot vibrating object that is finally absorbed until it rings down and is cooled through, as you say, spraying out all sorts of hot phonons in the system.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think these are all the possibilities for doing surface science on nanomechanical systems, but we've barely scraped the surface, scratched the surface here. That's a good point.
More questions?
Can you give us a sense for what the Reynolds numbers are
Yeah, no, I actually showed them. The Reynolds number are all, you know, of order one or smaller in these systems. But this is really low Reynolds number flow. Okay. So think about these things, at least in terms of their mechanical property, as like strings flopping in solution, like strings flopping in honey or something like that. That the mechanical response is completely determined by, you know, it's this over-damped, viscous response. But the reason why you get the high force sensitivity is still the exact deflections sort of on the subangstrom scale are the things that generate, for the scheme that I showed you, which was piezo-resistive transduction, we still have subangstrom scale displacement detection. And so that's what ultimately gives it, the combination of those is the thing.
I guess what I'm wondering is, as we scale the system, which way does the Reynolds number go? Is it possible to get a scheme where your Reynolds numbers will get large?
It's really hard. I mean, basically what we used in order to put the, by the way, I should acknowledge Mike Cross that I collaborated with, and really he's the brains behind doing the fluid, you know, coupling calculations. But what we just used is, you know, we went back to Stokes damping with a cylinder in solution. And so basically it scales linearly, you know.
Last question? No?
Okay. Yeah.
There's no more important questions. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll be around and I hope you ask me more questions.